Voice. Recording in progress and
Rabbi, can we dedicate our learning to the memory of Rabbi Simcha Krauss?
We certainly can. Rabbi Krauss is a former Maradatra of the Young Israel St. Louis, amongst other roles that he had in the over the course of his very long and illustrious career, and is a great loss to all of us, and certainly to the Jewish community and to the Jewish world in Israel and beyond. So certainly appropriate. Yeah. He's a Chor Baruch. All right. We are moving forward almost. Up until now, we've essentially... Does everybody see the screen? Yep. Okay. We've essentially dealt with, I would say, two primary and one secondary chet of David HaMelech. We started with the secondary one, the secondary one is the David Yoshev B'Yushalayim, the problem or the mistake that David begins with by not going and leading his people into the battle. But the two primary subjects of this parak that we've so far addressed has been his fateful night with Bathsheba, when he first sees Bathsheba Me'al HaGag from his vantage point upon the rooftop of his palace. And he desires her, and he has an investigation of who she is. And we spend some time talking about the legality of that in his own mind, right? The morality of it we'll still get to, but the legality of it, which is where his mind is at, we dealt with the question of the get, we dealt with the question of the Jewishness of Uriah Achiti, and whether that might have been a cause for his self-justification. In the end, none of these arguments are going to stand up to the critique of the Navi, but nonetheless, in David's mind, they are kind of a self-justification for in taking Bathsheba. We also talked about the fact that Bathsheba's marriage is an interesting dynamic, because on the one hand, her husband is one of David's loyal warriors. On the other hand, he's off in the battle. She's at home, and there are no children. And even the Tzar even says that they never really consummated the marriage. And it's a complex relationship, and David steps into that quicksand. And then we dealt with the question of Uriah. David calls Uriah back from the battlefield, and eventually sends him back after he judges him to be rebellious, and he has him killed in the midst of the battle. And so we've essentially dealt with two of the primary sins of David HaMelech in this parak, namely his engagement, his night with Bathsheba, and his execution, if you will, or his killing of Uriah Achiti. And that more or less covers most of this parak. David Yoshev B'Yushalayim, Ve'ilei Et Ha'erev, Ve'yakom Me'al HaGag, he sees Bathsheba, he seeks to understand who she is. Eshet Uriah Achiti, he calls Bathsheba, he lay with her. David finds out that she's with child. David calls Uriah back, gets a report of the war from Uriah, and then instructs Uriah to go to his house to spend the night with his wife. Uriah refuses for reasons yet unknown. Then David calls him back the next day and he says, why didn't you go down to your house? Uriah explodes in frustration. Everybody else is on the battlefield. Why should I go and eat, drink, and lay with my wife? The army is in the midst of the war. David says, okay, we'll stay till tomorrow. Again, tomorrow he doesn't go back. That night he doesn't go back to his house. And the next day, David writes a letter to Yoav, instructing Yoav to place Uriah at the front lines and leave him to be to die there. And so Uriah does. Uriah then sends a message back to David, instructing David that in fact Uriah and his company have all died at the Battle of Rabbah. And David instructs the Malach, the representative, the messenger, saying to him, "Go tell Yoav to finish the battle." And all of these things are happening in more or less in sequence.
Question.
Yeah.
There's something, maybe I'm just thinking, and maybe my head is just more in today's kind of terms.
Mm.
Uriah was an important person to David. Like, David knew who Uriah was.
Yes.
Uriah lived next door to David.
In a sense.
So how is it not possible that David already knew who Bathsheba was? Because it's not like she's sort of on the other side of town and he walks out and suddenly sees this person. Uriah, like, they're neighbors.
Yeah, I think it's a valid question. I'm not sure I have a good answer to that question, other than the fact that the social context of the world may have been different. Than it is today. That's not really an answer to the question, but we also know from a piece of the story that we'll come to later, which is that Bathsheba is much younger than Uriah. We'll see that in the context of the Navi's message to him in Perek Yudbet, almost to the point where Uriah almost raises Bathsheba like a daughter. Unclear, but it is.
But then David would have known that she was a part of Uriah's household.
Yes and no, maybe. At this point, David is king over a very large empire. It's been a long time since he's been running around with his band of 400 men. He knows Uriah from his younger days as a soldier amongst the Tzvah HaGiborim, but David has been in the world of Malchus less involved with the rank and file of the army for many years at this point.
Rabbi, maybe the opposite. Maybe because David was away at war, if you're saying Bathsheba's that young, maybe she was a child before and now she's an adult.
It is possible. Beyond what it says in the text, I don't really have much more to add to that question, except for the fact that that's what it says. Vayishlach David vayidrosh leisha. David sent to inquire who she was. It's also possible that he didn't see who it was who he saw. Like, he just saw somebody, he didn't know who it was, and so he inquired. And there may be a part of this story that's not in the text in terms of how he finds out who she is and then investigates the relationship and goes beyond. But I beyond that, I don't know beyond what's written in Pasuk Gimel. Fair question. And we get to all the way to the end of this parak. And the one conspicuous voice in this whole story is missing, and that is the Navi. Natan is nowhere to be seen. After David takes Bathsheba, Natan is nowhere to be seen. After David has Uriah killed, Natan is not in the story. And life goes on. I would even say, and I think we talked about this, that after the battle, the first battle with Ammon, when that failed, where Uriah's attack fails, David then gets what's written in the end of Perek Yudbet, even though it's written later, is really at this point in the story, namely, starting with this paragraph break here in Pasuk Chavah, Vayilachim Yoav Rabat Bnei Ammon, going back to the story of Yoav fighting against the city of Rabbah, even though this is after the Navi's critique, it's certainly happening earlier. It's happening really in the middle of Perek Yud Aleph, right before the end, right after, I suspect, the battle, the message that David gives to the messenger to go back to Uriah and say, finish this campaign, to Yoav and say, finish the battle. That's what he does. Vayilachem Yoav, vayilkod et iram lucha. Yoav attacks the city, breaks through the city, the walls, sends a message to David and says, we're there, we're ready, we're to go, come join us. David goes and he joins the army and he leads the campaign against Rabbah. And so I have the final battle against Ammon in the midst of all of this. And through all of this, we don't hear a word of the Navi. Until, go back to Perek Yud Aleph, Vatishma, after the battle, after Uriah's death, after I suspect the battle with Rabbah and the final death of, final campaign is over. Vatishma eshet Uriah ki met Uriah, isha, vatispod al ba'ala. Uriah's wife heard that Uriah died, and she offered a eulogy for her. She lamented her, her husband. She was, she sat shiva. She did the, she went through the mourning process. We talked a little bit about the dry superficiality of that, of that pasuk. Ve'avor ha'evel, the mourning passed. Shiva is over. Maybe the shloshim, maybe it's over too. I don't think much more than that. Vayishlach David vayasfa el beito vatihilo leisha. David sent to her and brought her into his house. She became his wife. Vateled lo ben, she bore him a son, which is a ironic statement, because she gave birth to the child that she conceived at the beginning of the story. The thing that David did displeased God, so that, next parak, Vayishlach Hashem et Natan el David. Natan sends, God sends Natan to David to begin Perek Yud Bet. You have to ask the question, where has he been for all these months or weeks? Why is he, does not a word about the affair that he has with Bathsheba when Uriah is still in the battlefield? Not a word about the murder of Uriah, which was clearly illegal and clearly David held accountable for. And until the very end of the story, he gets married and he has a child. And then suddenly Natan pops up.
Now, Rabbi, how are we to understand how close Natan was to David in terms of, was he constantly at the palace? Did he know all of David's comings and goings and what was going on? That
God certainly does. Vayera davar asher asad David b'nei Hashem v'yishlach Hashem et Natan. Natan is the Navi. God sent Natan to him.
Right, but
the question is as much question about why God is silent in this whole story as it is about Natan. I don't think Natan is going anywhere. I think he's the Navi. He's the Navi in Yerushalayim. What else is he going to be doing except being in Yerushalayim to help and guide David? And his silence through all of this is conspicuous. I would even argue that might have given David a kind of a false sense of, okay, you know, he's fine. He is managed to successfully navigate a complex situation.
But doesn't the Navi not only, but primarily respond when he hears the word of Hashem? So if Natan didn't hear anything from Hashem until this point, it seems to me that maybe he's not at fault in delay because he didn't
I'm not critiquing out of Natan. I'm not coming to critique Natan. I'm coming to ask the question.
Rabbi Shulman, yeah. It seems to me there's another voice missing, and that's of Bathsheba.
She never, you'll never hear her voice until Sefer Malach.
Right.
But that's not uncommon That's not necessarily uncommon in Tanakh. You are correct, but that is not a...
I do find that a little troubling.
I mean, there's it's very hard to put modern sensibilities of marriage and relationships into the world of Tanakh. Tanakh doesn't have a lot of conversations between husband and wife in general. Look at Sefer Bereishit. Look at, I mean, even David and Bathsheba, with everything else that's said and done, David and Bathsheba post this parak have two interactions, and they're both in Sefer Malachim, and they're both about the heir to the throne. And the rest of the story, there's no interaction with Bathsheba at all. But that's not a reflection of a critique. That's just the style of Tanakh. It's just not. It's a different focus. So that piece of it, I hear it, but I'm less concerned about it because it's not out of character. We don't hear a lot of the relationship of the conversation between David and Michal, except for the two conversations where Michal had and by Michal. It's the only place in all of Tanakh it says Michal that a woman loved a man. Is the first story of that night when Michal tells David, you know, falls in love with David, and then Michal has to enable David to escape. But it's very uncharacteristic and uncommon.
Rabbi Shulman, you also pointed out a few weeks ago that we're not sure how much Bathsheba agreed to this, or this was forced upon her, or it was marut, or
in that first initial relationship, that is true. The point at which she comes into his household as his wife, I'm sure that that was.
Changed.
Yeah, I'm sure that was by consensus and agreement. But it's still a mystery. God's reaction doesn't come until the very end. Vayera davar asher asah David is over the whole story. And Natan comes to him, and what's even more interesting is that when Natan comes to critique David, and he finally comes to David in the palace, Vayishlach Hashem et Natan al David, there's a part of the story which we're going to skip for now, just because it's too complex to get into without going through and learning it in detail, and that's this parable, this mashal that he gives to David. I'll come back to that Bezrat Hashem in a couple of weeks. But when Natan finally opens up and says to David, Ta'ish, this is about you, and he decrees upon David a terrible punishment for all that David did, if we read it through carefully and you listen, yet ask yourself the question, what is the Navi angry about? What is he reflecting God's anger about?
I made you king of Israel. I anointed you. I gave you deliverance from the hands of Shaul.
I gave you your master's house, wives into your bosom. And if that's not enough, I would give you much more. Why did you despise God? Why did you do this evil? Uriah, you had killed, and his wife you took to be your wife, and had him killed at the hands of Ammon. Therefore, the sword shall not depart from your household for eternity. You will be plagued by the sword. Because you have demonstrated, despised me and taken the wife of Uriah as your wife. Come, Hashem, in the name of Kimalachara Ami Betecha. I will cause an evil against you. I will take your wives from you before your own eyes. I will give them to your neighbor. And he shall lie with your wives in broad daylight. Kieta asita basata, you did this in secret. V'ani aset hadavar hazeh neged kol Yisrael v'neged hashamash. And I will do this in public. So
pretty harsh.
It's very harsh, and it deservedly so. We'll talk about what the gezeira is, but there's a part of the story that Natan critiques directly, and there's a part of the story that he seems to ignore. He's certainly critical of David having killed Uriah. He's very critical of David having married Bathsheba. But on their initial relationship, on the arias, on the adultery, on the affair that he has with her in the initial context, there's not a word. There's a hint, there's a remiss, there's an allusion. Maybe we'll kind of find it in the double expression of you took his wife. It says that phrase twice. Maybe. But again, it's about the marriage. It's about taking her as his wife. Where is Natan for all of the initial months of the story? It's almost as if I go back to Perek Yud Aleph for a second, it's almost as if he waits until after the marriage and after the birth of the child, Natelet lo ben, which means that Natan has waited 9 months, at least, before showing up in David's palace. It's a long period of time. That's after the Battle of Ammon. That's after David has come back to his house. He's after the wedding, after the birth of the child. So the core of the question is, and when I talk about Natan, I'm really talking about God's reaction, right? So they're one and the same. I'm not separating Natan from the message. No, I'm not separating the messenger from the message sender. But the question remains, why does Natan wait until so much time has gone by? Until after he marries Bathsheba, it's almost as if his primary critique is over the fact that David marries Bathsheba. But in the scope of things, that's the least offensive of everything David has done. By the time David marries Bathsheba, the reality is she's a widow, full-fledged legal widow. So there's nothing illegal. It might be something that nice, but there's nothing illegal in the marriage of David to Bathsheba. And yet that's the piece that really has driven Natan and driven God, that he married Bathsheba. That's really what's troubling Natan, that he married this poor widow who has nowhere else to turn, nowhere else to go. Of all the pieces of the story, I would have argued that that's probably the least offensive thing that David has done. Maybe
the punishment is, it doesn't just affect David, it affects his whole family and Klal Yisrael too.
That is true overall in Tanakh for many of the kings. That's the price you pay for being a king. God doesn't punish kings individually. They're sweeping consequences of history. There's much to be said about that, but that we'll get to Bezrat Hashem in Perek Yud Bet. But that's true overall, especially in House of Eli after the fall of Mishkan Shiloh. God's decree against the House of Eli is against Eli and all his descendants for all eternity. That's the way Gzirat HaMelech works. That's the way these decrees work. And so there is a point at which you have to ask the question, why is Natan waiting for so long? Why does, on the face of it, you could argue that it's kind of the straw to break the camel's back. You know, it's one offense after another. And so the first offense is David stays in Yerushalayim, and the second offense is Bathsheba, and the third mistake he makes is Uriah. And now by the time he makes the fourth mistake, which is to marry her, so now it's like just one, the proverbial straw to break the camel's back. Sort of to borrow the phrase from Sefer Amos, al shlosha pishei yisovi al haba'alo ashivenu, three offenses, three strikes. In biblical baseball, it's four strikes you're at, not three. So by the fourth offense already, David, the Navi can't hold back. On the other hand, David has, in a certain sense, David has successfully convinced himself, if you will, that all is well. His initial relationship with Bathsheba, whatever explanation you want to give, or whatever self-justification you want to identify, he thought that there was a get, or he thought that Uriah was not technically Jewish, and therefore Bathsheba wasn't really married, or for whatever the context is, David thought that initial relationship was justifiable, mistakenly so, but nonetheless, he could confuse himself. At the same time, he's kind of operating in this kind of energy of, when he finds out that she's pregnant and now he's in trouble, and so he calls Uriah from the field and he tries to cover up his mistake by having Uriah go home, and Uriah refuses, and then he's all frustrated about Uriah's rebellion, and so he sends a letter to Yoav and he has Uriah killed, and those first events are happening very quickly. Very quickly. But between those events and the marriage to Bathsheba and the birth of the child, now already you have months that have gone by. And if there's, sometimes you get so caught up in the moment of kind of the lack of judgment and mistakes that you make, that kind of one builds upon the other until you kind of have the time to step back, assess, look at everything that you've done and kind of say, okay, well, where was I miss, you know, kind of hindsight, the 2020 hindsight perspective, you certainly would have had the time to kind of assess where he's at. And yet now he's kind of looked back and said, okay, everything's fine. Natan is silent, God is silent, seems to be okay. I've managed to navigate through the initial events with Bathsheba, which were tumultuous, the initial issues with Uriah, which were tumultuous. Now Nebuch, she's a poor widow, and she's with child, and so he marries her, and everything is ready to move into, and they lived happily ever after mode. And then suddenly the Navi shows up and pours cold water over David's illusion. And it's a powerful moment. It's a powerful question. But the fact that Natan doesn't come until the end of the story, until after the marriage, until after the birth of the child, I think is not an accident. It's a reflection of several things we're going to come to in a second, but I think it's a reflection of, most importantly, this sense that David has convinced himself that, you know what, let time heal the wounds. Battle with Ammon is over. People of the army is back home. People are quiet. He's married Bathsheba. He'll look after the child. And at the end of the day, everybody will live, except for Uriah, everybody will live happily ever after. Okay? That's that more or less is the illusion that David has convinced himself. And into that illusion, into that world, Natan comes to shatter the picture. Alan, you had a question?
No, I was just saying, do we know at what point from Tanakh or other sources when David acknowledges this child as his son? Because right now,
there's no question that the child is his son. There's no question that the child is his son.
Yeah, but is it? We know that, but I'm talking about the acknowledgement to the rest of the world that it's his son. He could have married the widow who was pregnant from her husband.
He could have. He could have also married her and gotten pregnant after he married her. These events are happening very quickly. The initial events, including the marriage, is happening very quickly between the battle, Uriah's death, second battle of Ammon, and he marries her, is very quick. It's entirely possible that the child is, at least from the perspective of anybody who doesn't know the story, that child is David and Bathsheba's child. There's no, a child born, they didn't have ultrasounds in those days. 9 months, 8 months, 7 months, it's all a blur. And so the more likely scenario that I think David was hopeful for was that people would think that the child was his after he marries her, not before.
Okay.
That is my suspicion, but we never get to there because the child dies, but that's a separate issue we'll come to. But I want to spend a few minutes talking about this, the fact that Natan doesn't come until after he marries Bathsheba. There's something both kind of ironic and kind of uncomfortable with the fact that through the entire tumultuous period, that the world of the role of a Navi is to critique the king and to keep the king on the straight and narrow. Through the entire process of the night with Bathsheba and the taking of Bathsheba and then the conversations with Uriah and ultimately the death of Uriah and the battle with Ammon, through all of that, we don't hear a word of Natan. He might have been there, he might have had conversations with David, we don't know, but we're not hearing the critique. The critique, Vayera Davar Shrasa David, Bnei Hashem, starts after David marries Bathsheba. And that's the least offensive of all of David's actions. Right? She's a widow. And to a large extent, a widow who has no future, because anybody who finds out about David is becomes more complicated. But David has compassion for her. David has a relationship with her, and he invites her to join him as his wife, and she agrees. And one could raise questions, but at the end of the day, that's seems to be the least offensive of all of David's actions in this parak. And yet that's the one that the Navi is so super critical of. Uriah hiti kita b'cherev, that ishto lakachta l'chalisha. Uriah you had killed, and his wife you took as your wife. And the affair that he had with her and the child that he conceived with her when she was still married, where is that in the story? This phrase needs to be understood. So I want to take a break for a moment and take a look at a completely different story in Tanakh. I'm going to learn together with you today a completely different parak in Tanakh, and then see where it brings us here. So we're going to turn our attention to Sefer Malachim Aleph Parak Chaf Aleph. Malachim Aleph Parak Chaf Aleph is a story of Achav. We've encountered Achav before. We haven't done this in chronological sequence, but Achav is many years later. But Achav, king of Israel, northern kingdom, is a complex persona. On the one hand, he's a great warrior and loyal to his people to a fault. On the other hand, he marries Izebel, daughter of Et Baal. Who is Izebel? His wife is important to the story. Just so we have a context, Achav is married to the daughter of the king of Sidon, the king of Sidon, who is a Canaanite king. The names are very telling. Izebel is short for Eshet Baal, Iz Baal, and her father's name is Et Baal, which is Ish Baal. And in the same way, the kings of Israel incorporate the name Shem Hashem into their names, Chizkiyahu, Yoshiyahu, right? Did kings of idolatrous pagan cultures did the same thing. And so you have Izebel Bat Et Baal, aka Eshet Baal, daughter of Ish Baal. To tell you the context of the idolatrous culture, Izebel, princess of the northern city of king of Sidon. So the story of Izebel is a whole different. I've often referred to Izebel and her daughter at kind of the wicked witch of the of Tanakh. She's a piece of work, but that's our story for now. Came to pass, and there was a vineyard in the valley of Emek Israel in Jezreel Valley that belonged to a gentleman by the name of Navot. Etzel Hechal Achav Melech Shomron. This valley, this vineyard, which was in the valley of Emek Israel, was very close to the palace of Achav, king of Shomron. Vayidaber Achav al Navot, lemor, Achav spoke to Navot, engaged in a negotiation with him, and said to him, Tna li et karmecha, sell me your vineyard. Give me your vineyard. I'd like to expand my palace and include the rose garden, include the vineyard next to my palace. Vayili legan yarak, it should be a garden of herbs. Ki hu karov etzel biti, it's very close to my house, it's very convenient. And however, Achav is a fair negotiator. Vetna lecha tachtav kerem tov mimenu. Im tov be'enecha, tna lecha kesef b'chirza. And I'll pay you for it. I'll compensate for you for it. I'll give you a better vineyard for it, or I'll pay you its fair value, whatever you want. Vayomer Navot el Achav, Navot's response to Achav, Chalila li me'ashem mititi et nachalat avotai lach. God forbid that I should give away my family inheritance. Meaning, to Navot, it was more than about the vineyard and the compensation. This was about a piece of land that was in his family lineage. It was his ancestral land. And the emotional, familial ties were such that he didn't want to sell it. So more or less, that would end the story. Achav wants to buy the land, and Navot's not selling. Achav goes home and does the equivalent of what we would call a temper tantrum. Achav el beto, sar v'zaef, sullen and displeased, ala davar shediber elav Navot Israeli, because of this that Navot Israeli had said to him, vayomer lo aten lechad nachlat abatai, refused the king, he said, I'm not going to sell you my inheritance and my forefather. He went to bed. Vayasev et panav, he turned his head to the wall. V'lo achal lachem, he refused to eat. He had a full-blown tantrum. Depressed, not eating. He is distraught. He wants this vineyard, and poor Achav, Navot won't sell it. But the vaylav Izebel ishto. Izebel comes to him. But to the berilav, and she speaks to him. She says to him, Ma zeruchacha sara, v'encha achal lachem, what, you missed dinner? Your spirit is so sullen, you're so sad. Achav, what's wrong? He said to her, Ki edaber o Navot ha-Israeli, v'amar lot na li et karmacha bekesef o im chafetz ata et na lecha kerem tachtav. I was negotiating with Navot ha-Israeli. I said to him, I want your vineyard, I'll pay you for it, or I'll give you another vineyard for it. V'yomer lo eten lecha et karmi. And he said, I won't sell it to you. Kind of reminds me of the story there's a few places in Tanakh where the conversation that's relayed back is missing key pieces, right? So Achav doesn't say to Izebel, he won't sell it to me because it's his ancestral land, his family land, and he doesn't want to depart with it. He just says that Navot's response was, Lo aten lachat karmi, I don't want to give you my vineyard. So he left out a key piece of the argument. But nonetheless, I don't think it would have made any difference. Izevel's response was, Vatomer elav Izevel ishto, Ata tasem melucha Yisrael? You are a king in Israel? What kind of a king are you? Okay. Achav, see who can manage this one. Kum achol lechem. Yiten libecha. Get up. Go eat bread. Go eat. Go rejoice. Ani eten lechat kerem navota Yisraeli. You leave this to me. I know how to deal with these things. I will make sure you get this vineyard. Don't ask too many questions. Leave it with me. I'll take care of it. Okay? Vatichtov svarim b'shem Achav. So she wrote letters in the king's name. Vatachtom b'chotamo. And she sealed them with his seal. Vatishlach svarim b'shem Achav. Excuse me? ותשלח ספרים אל הזקנים ואל החורים אשר בעירו יושבים את נבות. And he sent the letters to the elders and nobles in the city where Navot lived. And in these letters, ותכתוב בספרים לאמור, in these letters she wrote the following. קראו צום והושיבו את נבות בראשה. Proclaim a fast and set Navot at the head of the people. Voshivu shnayim anashim b'nei Belial, and set two men whose value system is such that they are easily bought. Let's put it that way. V'yayidu lemor, and these two people let them testify against Navot, saying, Berachat Elohim b'melech, you cursed God and you cursed the king. And accuse him of blasphemy and treason. Both by offenses, by the way, are punishable by death. Not enough to just one or the other, but both each of them is punishable by death. Accuses Navot of doing both. And take him out, stone him, and he'll die. The people of the city did exactly as Izevel commanded them. You do not say no to Izevel. That people learned a long time ago. As was written in these letters. They proclaimed a fast. They put Navot at the head. They held a court case. And in this court case, two men of base, worthless men came, vayeshu nekdo, vayeidu, they testified against him, and they said, and Shehe Belial et Navot neged ha'am lemor, they testified these people against Navot, saying, Berach Navot Elohim b'malach. Navot cursed God and cursed the king. Committed blasphemy, committed treason. Yotziyu michutz la'ir, so they took Navot out of the city, vayiskeluhu ba'avanim v'yamot, stoned him and he died. Vayishlechu et Izevel emo. They sent a note to Izevel saying, Sukal Navot v'yamot. Navot has been stoned, Navot is dead. Vayikishma Izevel ki sukal Navot v'yamot. When Izevel heard that Navot was dead and stoned, Vatoma Izevel el Achav. Several of them went back to her husband and said, Kum resh t'keram Navota Israeli. Go take possession of the vineyard of Navota Israeli, Hashemein letet lecham bekesef, who refused to give it to you with money. Ki ein Navot chai, ki met. Navot is no longer alive. He's now dead, and his vineyard is yours for the taking. Why is it yours for the taking? Some suggest that because she accused him of treason, if you died by treason, your possessions become owned by the king. If that's the nature, there's some of the mafreshim suggest that as well. Achav heard that Navot died. Vayakam Achav avedet el kerem Navot Yisraeli l'rishto. Achav rose up and he went down to the kerem Navot of Navot, and he took possession of it. Now, before I move to the next piece of the story, there's a number of very striking parallels to the story of David. Between Uriah and Navot, right? Or the innocent person who's, in a sense, put to death by unjustifiably by decree of the king. In David's case, David had written that decree, and in Achav's case, that was written by Izebel and forged in his name. But there is a certain irony in that parallel. There's also a certain point, there's also some room to be melamed zchus, as they say, to give Achav some benefit of the doubt in the story, because even though Achav certainly wants this vineyard, and even though Achav having a temper tantrum that he can't have this vineyard, did Achav kill Navot? No, Izebel did. Achav know that Izebel was orchestrating a trumped up trial of false trial and hiring false witnesses to accuse Navot of blasphemy and treason when Navot was an innocent and loyal God-fearing Jew? Achav knew nothing about it. All Achav knew was, Izebel said to him, don't worry about it, I'll take care of it. She comes back 2 hours later and said, done, Achav is dead. Navot is dead, the vineyard's yours. And in response to Izebel's comment, okay, Navot is dead, the vineyard is yours, what does Achav do? Does he challenge her? Does he respond and say, how did you do this? What did you do? Right? No. Achav's attitude is?
Go get the vineyard.
Well, on the one hand, he gets the vineyard. And on the other hand?
Thank you.
No, I don't think he says thank you. I think he says, the less I know, the better.
You're no evil.
The less I know, the better. Because otherwise she would tell him. Otherwise, they'd plan it together. She would say to him, okay, let's go plan out a false accusation against this Navot that he committed treason, and you'll get the vineyard. You know, she never tells Achav what she's going to do, because it's so anti-Israelite. It's like it's so anti-Jewish what she's done. But she's not an Israelite. She's a Canaanite. This is for her. This is the world in which she comes from. This is Diragur. This is Ma'asim B'Choyom. This is what she grew up with. You want to deal with the stuff? You deal with the stuff like a king. That's why she starts by saying to him, what kind of a king are you? Ata, ta, tasem luchabi Israel. You are a king of Israel? I'll show you how to be a king or how to be a queen. And she does. And she goes and she does what in her hometown of the Canaanite town of Sidon. This is how they would deal with things like this. And so when she comes back to Achav and says, Ein avot chai kimet, when Achav heard that Navot died, he doesn't say to her, oh, how did that come about, right? He says, you know what? I don't want to know.
This is
whatever you did, I don't want to know about it.
But you don't think he knew anything? I mean, you really think he was not knowledgeable of what she was doing?
I'm assuming it all happened very quickly. And at this point, I can assume, even if I assume at face value, I'll take it at face value. I'll show you why, but I'll take it at face value that he knew nothing. Alan, what were you going to say?
Just as a classic case here at the end of don't ask, don't tell.
Yeah. He really, honestly, the conspicuous absence of what did you do, in part because I think he knows what he's dealing with in his wife. I think he knows what he's ever capable of. And in part, remember, she's the prophetess who brings Baal into the land of Israel. She's the one who orchestrates the 400 the showdown with Eliyahu and Har HaKarmel. She's the one who sends the Nevi'im out to try to, her false prophets to try to kill Eliyahu. This is all Yizevel. Yizevel, as I said, is the wicked witch of Tanakh. Vahikishma, he heard together with her daughter by the name of Ataliah. Vahikishma Achav kimet Navot. When Achav heard that Navot died, Vayakum Achav laredet el kerem Navot Israeli levishto. All he says is, okay, hear no evil, see no evil. I don't know anything. I am asking. I'm just going to go and I'm going to take the vineyard. God comes to Eliyahu, and Eliyahu, and he instructs Eliyahu as follows. Kum red likrat Achav melech Yisrael asher b'Shomron. Go and meet Achav, king of Israel. Go down to the Shomron. Hinei bekeren navot asher yirat l'shem l'rishto. And you'll find him lying on his hammock in the vineyard of Navot, where he went to take possession. B'dibarta elav lemor, and thus you shall say to him, Koma Hashem, haratzachta v'gam yarashta? You killed and took possession? Not enough that you killed him, but then you went and you took his land? One of the most famous expressions in Tanakh. Haratzachta v'gam yarashta? You killed him and took his possession? V'dibarta elav. And you'll say to Acha, Koma Hashem, במקום משיר לקקוע כלבים את דם נבות, ילוקו הכלבים את דמך גם אתה. Where the dogs licked up the blood of Navot because they stoned him outside of the city in the middle of the field, the dogs will lick your blood. Meaning, decrees upon Achav a very gruesome death. Vayomer Achav el Eliyahu. Achav says to Eliyahu, Am tzatani oivi, have you found me, my enemy? You, Eliyahu, remember Har HaKarmel, remember the showdown. Vayomer, matzati, yan hitmakkercha la'asot hara b'nei Hashem. I have found you, because you have given yourself over to do that which is evil in God's eyes. Hineni mevi alecha ra'ahu v'yarti acharecha. I will bring evil upon you, sweep you away. Hichirati la'achav mashtin b'kir v'atzur v'azur b'Yisrael. I will cut off from Achav every line of every male child and anybody who was left in Israel. And as for Yizevo, she's not getting away with this. The dogs will eat Yizevo in the valley of Israel. He that dies in Achav's entourage and family will, in the city, the dogs will eat, the ones who die in the field, the fowls will eat. The bottom line is, and this is something to process, the decree here was death without burial. It's a very gruesome way of describing it, but the short of it is that they'll die in such a way that they will not come to Kever Yisrael, they will not be properly buried, which is in the language, in the frame of reference of Tanakh, one of the harshest decrees that you can give to somebody, because it's one thing to say that they'll die, but then the soul is eternal. But it's another thing to say that they will die without burial. Without burial has all kinds of ramifications as well. And so that's essentially a very gruesome but a very graphic way of describing death in such a way that they won't come to they won't have the dignity of a state funeral, if you will. Right? They'll die without burial. But the fascinating part about this is this phrase, Haratzachta v'gam yarashta. Now, Achav didn't kill Navot. He's Evel did. And yet when Eliyahu comes to Ahav and he says to him, Haratzachta, did you kill and take possession? And why didn't Ahav respond and say, I didn't kill him. What are you talking about? I had nothing to do with it. I mean, you really want to throw her under the bus? You could say it was all these Evel's fault. That's what Adam Arishan did. Right? But he doesn't get that chance because Eliyahu just blurts out the Gezerah. Haratzachta v'gamirashta? What did he do? Ahav did literally the smallest part of this whole story. He went and he took possession of the land. He had nothing to do with the murder. He had nothing to do with killing Nevot. That was all he's ever.
But he's an accomplice after the fact.
In what way?
Because
they're
considered one unit.
Murder. He's considered one unit, king and queen, right? Husband and wife.
He's still the king. Hand,
in the context here of the Navi, he doesn't say to Ahav, your wife did this, I'm holding you accountable. Right? That would be a different language. Right? And he doesn't say you could have stopped her. Even that he doesn't say. What does he say to her? What does he say to him?
It's your fault. You did it.
Why? But he didn't do it. He didn't even know about it. As he didn't sign the letter, those letters were forged in his name. He didn't falsely accuse Nevot. That false accusation came from two people that Izebel hired. He knew nothing about the plot. So why is he responsible for it?
Well, but by mentioning it to...
And he basically appointed her.
Right, that's what I was saying.
He didn't appoint her. He didn't ask her to do anything.
But by telling her why he was sad, he's basically saying, you know, suggesting she take care of it.
But it's
fascinating. If she says she'll take care of it and he doesn't stop her.
But he doesn't say to, Eliyahu doesn't say to Ahav, why did you let her do this? That's not in the conversation here. It's you, Haratzachta v'gamirashta. And Ahav has perfect excuses. He didn't sign the letter.
Into Israel. He married her and he made her queen and gave her this power.
I get all of that. That's not what Eliyahu says. I hear you, but that's not what he says. What he says is, Haratzachta v'gamirashta? What he says is, Ahav, the moment you walked into the field of Nevot and took possession of it, you were guilty of Nevot's murder. It's the Yerush, it's the possession, it's the taking of the Kerem that is the substance of the issue against Ahav. The Navi has no problem holding Izebel accountable, separate from Ahav. That's not the question. Izebel does lots of things that Ahav doesn't agree with. And they're held accountable separately. The decree against Izebel has already been made. This is just adding another step now. But the issue here is that Ahav is all of the excuses that Ahav has, and he has excuses. He has justifications. He can say he didn't know. He can say she acts without his permission, which is true. He can say he didn't have anything to do with the false court case, which is true. He didn't sign the letters, which is true. None of that, however, will hold a day in the court of the Navi the moment Ahav goes to take the vineyard, because then he benefits from the crime. And that, says the Navi, makes him the accomplice. That phrase, Haratzachta v'gam yarashta, and it's not, if you think about it, ironically, it should be the other way around, right? We'll go from the lesser crime to the greater crime. Which is the greater crime? Killing Nevot or taking the vineyard? Killing Nevot. But he had nothing to do with that. He's just held accountable for it because he went the extra step to benefit from it. And in the language of the Navi, remember, and this is the critical piece, the role of the Navi is not to come and tell you what it says in the Shulchan Aruch. The role of the Navi is not to come and tell you that it says in the Torah, Lo Tirtzach. The role of the Navi is not to come and tell us that which is self-explanatory and obvious. The role of the Navi is to come and tell us the moral frame of reference that God holds us accountable for beyond that which is just written in the text. That Ezebel is guilty of murder is no question. But that Ahab takes possession of the vineyard and thereby benefits from that evil, now he will be held accountable as well for all that has taken place. Haratzachta v'gam yarashta. Notice where Ahav meets Eliyahu. And God says to Eliyahu, go down to Ahav in the Shomron. Hine bekerem navota she'arad sham lirishto. He's sitting there in the vineyard. Eliyahu meets him in the vineyard. That's exactly why that confrontation is there.
Isn't Eliyahu also a most wanted man for Ahab and Jezebel?
Yes, from a previous story, but that is correct.
Right. His behavior is a lot different than Natan's, that's for sure.
Well, I'm not holding Natan accountable here. I'm trying to understand, less so Natan as much as God. Don't misunderstand my initial question. It's not about where Natan was, it's about where God was. And why does the Navi's message to Navid wait until the very end? And the answer is, in the same way, in exactly the same fashion, what Eliyahu could have walked into the palace the moment Ezebel was planning and plotting and revealed the plot before Naboth was killed.
You could have. So he was waiting until after, right? David
the
had
don't work that way. But that's not the way the Nevi'im work. The Nevi'im don't work by kind of interfering with every act of evil. Right? We are creatures of choice. We take the consequences of our actions. The role of the Navi is to draw our attention to what those consequences are and identify where the moral lapse belongs. But the Navi is not going to interfere with the choice of good or evil. That's on the king.
No, but I'm saying there's Natan, God waits because it hasn't reached full fruition. In other words, David. Ahav's not in his vineyard. The baby has to be born before.
Well, we'll come to the baby in a second, but yes, the baby has to be born. But I think that Ahav, that the parallel is Vatehilo le'isha vatehilo. The parallel is, it's one thing to talk about the night of the affair when David is drawn to her. It's another thing to talk about the execution of Uriah when David is convinced that Uriah is guilty of treason, and whatever illusions and lies that David has convinced himself, they're all in David's mind, they're all true. But the moment he marries her, the moment he takes her after Uriah's death and marries her,
that's the vineyard.
The Isha, David has crossed the very line that Ahav crossed. The phrase, Vatihilu Isha, if you look at the language of the Navi, Natan, when he says to her, to David, Et Uriah Chiti Kita Bacherev, Ve'et Ishto Lakachta Lachal Isha, Uriah you had killed, and you took his wife for your wife, that is exactly the same phrase as Haratzachta v'gam yarashta. That's exactly the same phrase. Committed murder and then you took possession. You killed Uriah and then you took possession. And then you took his wife.
But Natan doesn't step in until after the baby's born.
Correct. And we'll talk about that Bezrat Hashem next week. There's another variable here, which is the baby, which could very well be just a matter of waiting until everything has calmed down and David has literally deluded himself into thinking that he's gotten away with this. And then the Navi comes and says, how little you understand.
Well, isn't that similar with Ahab in the sense that he committed the sin of coveting his neighbor's land? His neighbor was killed, and then he thought he got away with it as well. Until
David committed the sin of coveting his neighbor's wife, 100%. The parallel between the two stories is very striking, 100%, and that's the power of the phrase "haratzachta v'gam yerashta," the audacity to take possession and benefit from the very act of whether you physically killed or had him killed or didn't know but allowed your wife to have him killed. Whatever the circumstances are, he will be held accountable for the retzach, for the murder of Navot, because he took possession of the field. In the same way that David will be held accountable for the murder of Uriah, despite whatever justification he thinks, because he went and he took his wife.
But David ordered the killing of Uriah, where in this case with Ahav, he wasn't that involved.
Correct, which means that there's an element that's even more significant, more directly involved with David. On the other hand, David can make the argument, which he has to himself, that Uriah was guilty of treason and therefore deserved to die, etc. The Navi comes to him and says, not in my book.
And that may be Ahab took the same position with Navot, that he was guilty of treason.
I mean, Isabel took it.
And that's what Isabel accuses him of, correct.
But Rabbi, there are instances where the Navi does warn the different kings about things before they do it. You know, like Shaul got a lot of warnings from Shmuel.
But it's different. The warnings are, I'm sending you on this mission. Here's the pitfall. Don't fall into it. That's different. That's very different. All right. We will, I think we're going to stop here. I know we're 4 minutes early, but that's okay. I don't want to start the next unit. I would just kind of preface a question that we're going to address next week, which is coming back. This will be our last subunit in Perikid Aleph before we move on to Perikid Bet. We've now kind of looked at all of the pieces of the puzzle from the beginning to the end. David not going to Yerushalayim, David in sees Batsheva, David desires Batsheva, he takes her, then he has he finds out about the child and he takes Uriah and he has Uriah brings him hopefully go back to his house. Uriah refuses. Uriah is guilty of treason, sends Uriah off to die, marries Batsheva, and then the Navi comes and says Aratzachta begam yerashta. It's an extraordinarily complex and tragic story with many parts to it. Overall, a story I wish it never happened, but it didn't. That's nonetheless what we have to leave ourselves with. The question I want to explore in our sort of our final piece of it is, what's driving David? What is the overarching issue that is driving David's spiral of mistakes? Is there something specific? Is there a common thread between all of the different mistakes that David makes in this whole story? And can we identify it, or is it just one kind of getting pulled from one direction to another and kind of a lack of judgment because of the circumstances of his life? So we will explore that question, Bezrat Hashem, next week. That's sort of the last piece of the story. And then we will move on to Perek Yud Bet.
I think it's more of, oh, what a tangled web we weave.
Entirely possible. So that's what we will explore.
Okay. Thank you, Rabbi.
Thank you so much.
Take care.
Okay.
Thank you.